They waited until nightfall before they left the concealment of the papyrus and climbed the low earth bank onto the open pasture. The horse's hooves made almost no sound on the soft sand. Through the darkness, Nakontu led them to the trees that were silhouetted against the stars. Once they were under the spreading, protecting branches, he turned parallel to the edge of the swamp. They rode in silence for only a short while before he turned into the forest, where they had to bend low on the backs of the horses to avoid the overhanging foliage. They had not gone far, when above the treetops ahead the night sky was suffused with a rosy glow. Nakontu led them towards it. Now they could hear drums beating a frenetic rhythm. As they moved towards it, the sound grew louder until the night throbbed like the heart of the earth. Closer still, a chorus of discordant chanting joined the pounding of the drums. Nakontu stopped them at the edge of the forest. Taita rode up beside Merin, and they looked across an expanse of cleared ground to a large village of primitive thatch and mud-daub huts lit by the flames of four huge bonfires, sparks streaming up in torrents. Rows of smoking racks stood beyond the last huts, covered with the split carcasses of fish whose scales glittered like a sheet of silver in the firelight. Around the bonfires, dozens of human bodies twisted, leapt, and spun. They were painted from scalp to heels in glaring white, decorated with weird designs in black, ochre, and red mud. Taita realized they were of both sexes, all naked under their coating of white clay and ash. As they danced, they chanted in a barbaric cadence, a sound like the baying of a pack of wild animals. Suddenly, from out of the shadows, another band of prancing and cavorting Luo dragged one of the stolen horses. All of the horsemen recognized her. A bay mare named Starling. The Luo had knotted a bark rope round her neck, and five of them were heaving on it as a dozen more shoved at her flanks and hindquarters or goaded her cruelly with pointed sticks, blood glistening from the wounds they inflicted. One of the Luo lifted a heavy wooden club in both hands and rushed at her. He aimed a heavy blow at her head, and the club cracked against her skull. She dropped instantly to kick spasmodically, her bowels voided in a liquid green rush. The painted Luo swarmed over her carcass, brandishing their flint knives. They hacked off lumps of her still twitching flesh and crammed it into their mouths. Blood dribbled down their chins to run across their painted torsos. They were a pack of wild dogs fighting and howling over a kill. The watching troopers growled with outrage. Merin glanced sideways at Taita, who nodded, "Left and right wheel into extended order." Merin gave the command low but clear. On each flank the two columns opened like wings into an extended line. As soon as they were in position, Merin called again. "Detachment will charge. Present arms!" They cleared their swords from their sheaths. "Forward, march, trot, gallop, charge!" They swept forward in close formation, the horses running shoulder to shoulder. The Luo were in such a frenzy that they did not see the troopers coming until they burst into the village. Then they tried to scatter and run, but it was too late. The horses swept over them, crushing them beneath their hooves. The swords rose and fell, the blades thumping through bone and flesh. The two Shaluk were at the front of the charge, howling, stabbing, leaping, and stabbing again. Taita saw Nakontu send a spear clean through the body of one, so that the point stood out between the Luo's shoulder blades. When Nakontu cleared it, it seemed to suck out with it every drop of blood from the man's body, a black spray in the firelight. A painted woman with pendulous dugs that hung to her navel raised both arms to cover her head. Merin stood in his stirrups and hacked off one of her arms at the elbow, then swung the blade again and split her unprotected head like a ripe melon. Her mouth was still crammed with raw meat, which spewed out with her death wail. The troopers kept their tight formation, riding down the Luo, their sword arms rising and falling in a deadly rhythm. The Shaluk caught those who tried to break away. The drummers, seated before the long, hollowed-out trunks of the Kigelia tree, were in such a transport that they did not even look up. They continued beating out their frenzied rhythm with their wooden clubs until the horsemen rode over to cut them down where they sat. They fell, writhing and bleeding, onto their drums. At the far side of the village, Merin checked the charge. He looked back and saw no one still standing. The ground around Starling's carcass was covered with the painted naked bodies. A few of the wounded were trying to crawl away. Others were groaning and thrashing in the dust. The two Shulluk were running among them, stabbing and howling in murderous ecstasy. "Help the Shulluk finish them," Meron ordered. His men dismounted and went swiftly over the killing ground, dispatching any who showed signs of life. Taita reined in alongside Meron. He had not been in the first rank of the charge, but had followed close behind. "I saw a few run into the huts," he said. "Root them out, but don't kill them all. Nakonto might glean good information from them about the country ahead." Meron shouted the order to his captains, who went from hut to hut, ransacking them. Two or three Luo women ran out wailing with young children. They were hustled into the centre of the village, where the Shulluk guides shouted orders to them in their own language. They forced them to squat in rows with their hands clasped on top of their heads. The children clung to their mothers, tears gleaming on their terrified faces. "Now we must find the surviving horses," Meron shouted. "They cannot have slaughtered and eaten them all. Search there first." He pointed into the dark forest from which they had seen the butchers drag Starling to the slaughter. Hilto took his troop with him and rode into the dark. Suddenly a horse whinnied. "They are here!" Hilto shouted happily. "Bring torches!" The men tore thatch from the roofs of the huts and made crude torches with it, lit them and followed Hilto into the forest. Leaving five men to guard the captured women and children, Meron and Taita followed the torchbearers. Ahead, Hilto and his men called directions, until in the thickening light they made out the herd of stolen animals. Taita and Meron dismounted and ran to them. "How many are left?" Meron asked urgently. 11 only. We have lost 6 to the jackals," Hilto replied. "The Luo had tied them all to the same tree on cruelly short ropes. They could not even stretch their necks to the ground." "They have not been allowed to graze or drink," Hilto shouted indignantly. "What kind of beasts are these people?" "Free them," Meron ordered. Three troopers dismounted and ran to obey. But the horses were so crowded together that they had to push between them. Suddenly a man bellowed with outrage and pain. "Beware! One of the Luo is hiding here. He has a spear and he has wounded me." Suddenly there were the sounds of a scuffle, followed by a high-pitched childish scream from among the horse's legs. "Catch him! Don't let him get away!" "What is happening there?" Meron demanded. "A little savage is hiding here. He is the one who speared me." At that, a child darted out from among the horses, carrying a light assegai. A trooper tried to grab him, but the child stabbed at him and vanished into the darkness in the direction of the village. Taita had only a brief glimpse of him before he was gone, but he sensed something different about him. The Luo, even the children, were stocky and bow-legged, but this one was as slender as a papyrus stem, and his legs were elegantly straight. He ran with the grace of a frightened gazelle. Abruptly, Taita realized that beneath the white clay and tribal designs, the child was female, and he was struck by an intense sensation of déjà vu. "I swear to all the gods I've seen her before," he murmured to himself. "When I catch the little swine, I'll kill him slowly," the wounded trooper shouted, as he came out from among the horses whence he had flushed the child. There was a spear wound in his forearm, and blood dripped from his fingertips. "No!" Taita shouted urgently. "It is a girl. I want her taken alive. She has run back towards the village. Surround the area and search the huts again. She will have gone to ground in one." Leaving a few men to deal with the recovered horses, they galloped back to the village. Meron threw a cordon around the huts, and Taita questioned Nakontu and Nontu, who were guarding the women and their children. "Did you see a child run this way, about this height, and covered, like the rest of them, with white clay?" They shook their heads. "Apart from these," Nakonto indicated the wailing captives, "we have seen no one." "She can't have gone far," Meron assured Taita. "We have the village surrounded. She cannot escape. We will find her." He sent Habari's platoon in to carry out a hut-by-hut search. When he came back to Taita, he asked, "Why is the murderous brat important to you, Magus?" "I am not certain, but I think she is not one of the Luo. She is different. She might even be Egyptian." I doubt that, Magus. She is a savage, naked and covered with paint. Catch her, Taita snapped. Merrin knew that tone and hurried to take command of the search. The men went slowly and cautiously, none wanting to risk a spear thrust in his belly. By the time they were halfway through the village, dawn was breaking over the forest. Taita was troubled and restless. Something gnawed at him, like a rat in the granary of his memory. There was something he must remember. The dawn breeze veered into the south, wafting to him the stench of half-rotten fish from the smoking racks. He moved away to avoid it, and the memory he was seeking rushed in. Where else would you search for a moonfish? You will find me hiding among the other fishes. It was the voice of Fen, speaking through the mouth of the stone image of the goddess. Was the child they were pursuing a soul caught up in the wheel of creation, the reincarnation of someone who had lived long ago? She promised to return, he said aloud. Is it possible? Or does my own longing delude me? And then he answered himself, There are things that surpass the wildest imagining of mankind. Nothing is impossible. Taita glanced around swiftly to make certain that nobody was watching him, then moved casually to the edge of the village and walked to the smoking racks. As soon as he was out of sight, his attitude changed. He stood like a dog testing the air for the scent of its quarry. His nerves jumped. She was very close, her presence almost palpable. Holding his staff at the ready to fend off a stroke from her assegai, he moved forward. Every few paces he went down on one knee to try to see under or between the racks on which the layers of fish were packed densely together. At intervals, bundles of firewood and drifting clouds of smoke obstructed his view. He had to circle each woodpile as he came to it, to make certain she was not hiding behind one, which slowed his progress. By now the rays of the early sun were flooding the village. Then, as he crept round another woodpile, he heard a stealthy movement ahead. He peered round the corner. Nobody was there. He glanced at the ground and saw the prints of her small bare feet in the grey ash. She was aware that she was being stalked, moving just ahead of him, darting from one woodpile to the next. "There is no sign of the brat. She is not here," he called to an imaginary companion, and started back towards the village. He went noisily, tapping the racks with his staff, then doubled back in a wide circle, moving swiftly and silently. He reached a position close to where he had last seen her footprints, and squatted behind a woodpile to wait for her. He was alert for any movement or the faintest sound. Now that she had lost sight of him, she would become nervous and change her position again. He threw a spell of concealment round himself. Then, from behind the screen, he reached out for her, searching the ether. "Ah," he murmured as he descried her. She was very close, but not moving. He sensed her fear and uncertainty. She did not know where he was. He saw that she was cowering under one of the woodpiles. Now he focused all his power on her, sending out impulses to lure her towards him. "Magus, where are you?" Merrin called from the direction of the village. When he received no answer, his voice rose urgently. "Magus, do you hear me?" Then he was coming towards where Taita waited. "That's right," Taita encouraged him silently. "Keep coming. You will force her to move. Ah, there she goes." The girl was moving again. She had crawled out from under the wood and was scurrying in his direction, running ahead of Merrin. "Come, little one." He tightened the tentacles of the spell round her. "Come to me." "Magus," Merrin called him much closer. The girl appeared in front of Taita at the corner of the woodpile. She paused to glance back toward where Merrin's voice had come from, and he saw that she was quivering with terror. She looked in his direction. Her face was a hideous mask of clay, her hair built up in a mass on top of her head, with a mixture of what looked like clay and acacia gum. Her eyes were so bloodshot from the smoke of the fires and the dye that had run from her hair that he could not make out the colour of the irises. Her teeth had been deliberately blackened. All of the Luo women they had captured had blackened their teeth and wore the same ugly hairstyle. Clearly, it was their primitive idea of beauty. As she stood there terrified, her head cocked, Taita opened his inner eye. Her aura sprang up around her, enveloping her in a sublimely magnificent cloak of living light, just as he had seen it in his dreams. Beneath the grotesque coating of clay and filth, this sorry, bedraggled creature was Fen. She had returned to him as she had promised. The emotion that swept over him was more powerful than any he had experienced in his long life. It surpassed in intensity the grief that had overwhelmed him at her death, which had ended her other life, when he had removed her viscera and wrapped her corpse in the linen bandages and laid her in the stone sarcophagus. Now she was restored to him, at the same age she had been when she had first been placed in his care all those bleak, lonely years ago. All that grief and sorrow was paid off with the single coin of joy, to which every cord, muscle, and nerve in his body resonated. The cloak of concealment he had spun round himself was disturbed by it. The child picked it up at once. She turned and stared in his direction, her bloodshot eyes enormous in the grotesque mask. She sensed his presence but could not see him. He realized that she possessed the power. As yet her psychic gift was undeveloped and untutored, but he knew that under his loving instruction it would in time match his own. The rising sun shot a beam into her eyes, and their true lustre glowed in the deepest shade of green. Fen green. Merrin was running in their direction, his footsteps pounding on the hard earth. There was only one escape route open to Fen, down the narrow passage between the woodpile and the smoking racks. She ran straight into Taita's arms. As they closed round her, she shrieked in shock and renewed terror and dropped the assegai. Although she struggled and clawed at his eyes, Taita held her close to his chest. Her fingernails were long and ragged, black dirt was caked under them, and they raised bloody welts across his forehead and cheeks. Still holding her with one arm circled round her waist, he took her arms one at a time and trapped them between their bodies. Now that she was helpless, he leant close to her face and stared into her eyes, taking control of her. Instinctively, she knew what he was doing, and pushed forward to meet him. But just in time, he divined her intention and jerked his head back sharply. Her sharp black teeth snapped shut, a finger's breadth from the tip of his nose. "Light of my eyes, I will have need of this old nose of mine. If you are hungry, I will provide tastier fare," he smiled. At that moment Merrin burst into sight, his expression of consternation and alarm. "Magus!" he shouted. "Do not let that filthy vixen near you. She has already tried to murder one man, and now she will do you some grave injury." He rushed towards them. "Let me get my hands on her. I will take her to the swamp and drown her in the nearest pool." "Back, Merrin!" Taita did not raise his voice. "Don't touch her." Merrin checked. "But Magus, she will—" "She will do no such thing. Go, Merrin. Leave us alone. We love each other. I just have to convince her of it." Still Merrin hesitated. "Go, I say. At once." Merrin went. Taita looked into Fen's eyes and smiled reassuringly. "Fen, I have waited so long for you." He was using the voice of power, but she resisted him fiercely. She spat, and bubbles of her saliva ran down his face to drip off his chin. "You were not so strong when we first met. You were sullen and rebellious. Oh, yes, indeed you were, but not as strong as you are now." He chuckled and she blinked. No Luo had ever emitted such a sound. A spark of interest flashed for an instant in the green depths of her eyes. Then she glared at him. "You were so beautiful then, but look at you now." His voice still carried the hypnotic inflection. "You are a vision from the void." He made it sound like an endearment. "Your hair is filthy." He stroked it, but she tried to duck. It was not possible to guess the true colour of her hair under the thick clay and acacia gum, but he kept his voice calm and his smile reassuring as a stream of red lice crawled out of the clotted mass and climbed up his arm. "By Ahura Mazda and the truth, you stink worse than any polecat," he told her. "It will take a month of scrubbing to get down to your skin." She wriggled and squirmed to be free. "Now you are rubbing your filth onto me. I shall be in no better case than you by the time I have quietened you. We shall have to camp away from Merrin and his troopers. Even rough soldiers will not withstand our combined odour." He kept speaking. The sense of the words was unimportant, but the tone and inflection gradually lulled her. He felt her begin to relax, and the hostile light in her green eyes faded. She blinked, almost sleepily, and he relaxed his grip. At that, she shook herself awake, and the malevolence flared again. He had to hold her hard as she renewed her struggles. "You are indomitable." He let the admiration and approval sound in his voice. "You have the heart of a warrior, and the determination of the goddess you once were." This time she quietened more readily. The migrating lice nipped Taita under his tunic, but he ignored them and continued to talk. "Let me tell you about yourself, Fen. You were once my ward, as you have become again. You were the daughter of an evil man who cared little for you. To this day I cannot fathom how he sired a lovely thing like you. You were beautiful, Fen, beyond the telling of it. Under the fleas, lice, and dirt, I know you are still." Slowly her resistance faded as he related her childhood to her in loving detail and recounted some of the funny things she had done or said. When he laughed now, she looked at him with interest rather than anger. She began to blink again. This time, when he relaxed his grip, he did not attempt to escape, but sat quietly in his lap. The sun had reached its zenith when at last he stood up. She looked up at him solemnly, and he reached down to take her hand. She did not pull away. "Come along now. If you are not hungry, I certainly am." He set off towards the village, and she trotted at his side. Merrin had set up a temporary camp well away from the village. In the sun, the Luo corpses would soon begin to rot, and the area become uninhabitable. As they approached the camp, he hurried to meet them. "I am glad to see you, Magus. I thought the vixen had done away with you," he shouted. Fen hid behind Taita and clung to one of his legs as Merrin came up to them. "By the wounded eye of Horus, she stinks. I can smell her from here." "Lower your voice," Taita ordered. "Ignore her. Do not look at her like that, or you will undo my hard work in an instant. Go ahead of us to the camp and warn your men not to stare at her or alarm her. Have food ready for her." "So now we have a wild filly to break." Merrin shook his head ruefully. "Oh, no. You underestimate the task ahead of us," Taita assured him.